WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for January 28th, 2018. Yep, the last Sunday in January as we bid adieu to the first month of the new year. This is our weekly look inside the world of politics and policy, from City Hall to the State House and all the way out to Washington, D.C. So yes, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, I have to tell you, I read a fabulous investigative story in the New York Times that was posted yesterday, and I believe it's in their Sunday print editions. And, you know, Dave, social media is kind of taking over the world as we know
kind
it.
Of.
Well,
it's here.
Yes. And this was just a fantastic, far-flung investigation into the world of social media and how the fact that people are so into how many followers they have and how that's become commercialized. And so celebrities want lots of followers to help establish their celebrity presence. Mm-hmm. And anybody in a corporate world, you know, wants to have a lot of followers to help them advance themselves in the corporate world. So, of course, did you know there's a company you can buy followers?
No, I did not.
I'm not kidding. And guess what? They're not.
So you can up the number of followers that you have this, on social media.
This company, which, by the way, removed their Twitter account this morning.
Isn't that interesting?
Uh-huh. But this company, for a relatively inexpensive amount, say for $2,000, you could buy 200,000 followers to your Twitter account.
How much money are you going to spend on this?
I'm not going to name any names, but there's also people in the media who have used this mm-hmm. to boost followers
yep.
account.
Yep.
But for $2,000, you get 200,000 followers, except they're not real.
Oh, so these numbers are...
No, they're bots.
Yeah.
And there's a company in the Philippines that you can buy bots from. And bots are not real people. They're phony, fake accounts.
So this is why I have 3 followers on Facebook.
I'm one of them.
Yeah, yes, you are. You're one of them.
But, no, I mean, and like Kathy Ireland... the former swimsuit model with her marketing company
mm-hmm.
would regularly buy followers, or her company would.
Just to make it look
like her company was even bigger.
Thousands and tens of thousands of followers.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
All to kind of help, you know, maybe I need some more capitalization for my company, but look, I've got all of these followers on social media. and then there was a story, I think a couple of weeks ago, I think it was in The Guardian, about these two teens who are known as influencers. And it's a term you're going to hear a lot about. And because of the vast number of people following them in social media, that if they tweeted out a preference for a certain soft drink, for example, the soft drink companies would pay them. They would pay them. And now that's become a new form of advertising. And so this was like, I believe a 14-year-old girl and 17-year-old brother. They're making over $100,000 a year from on advertising.
And, you know, you talk about the number of hits and people wanting, followers and likes and all of this and that on social media. I think you may have seen the story a week or two ago, which was appalling to start with, where a young man was encouraging people his age to eat the laundry detergent.
Yeah, the Tide
tablets.
Yes.
And through a Skype interview or somehow or other, the story I saw on Network News talked to the young man, and he was kind of giggling about it. He simply said, "Oh, I just wanted to see how many hits I could get."
Right. Well, this brother sister in Great Britain, it turns out their mom actually bought followers from this company that the New York Times wrote about.
Okay.
So it's this self-perpetuating kind of cycle of trying to monetize this goofy social media stuff.
Yeah, that's what's happening.
I mean, I use it.
We all do.
Yeah, I mean, but I use it largely to, you know, let people know what stories we've got in the Tribune or interesting stories that I see in other publications.
Or what's coming up on the program today.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Sure.
Occasionally I'll vent about the Blackhawks.
Yeah, I've seen that a time or two on there.
Or the Cubs or something. But no, but it just never dawned on me the idea that people would go out and try to monetize followers, and that there'd be a company well prepared. I mean, Michael Simon, the Iron Chef, great chef, he did it.
Yeah.
All as part of, you know, to show people that their business is important or they're important somehow.
Yeah, and so thus they have, you know, and people see tens of thousands of followers, and they want to get on the bandwagon. So they, you know, they all, well, I've got to be a follower if everybody else is doing this.
Right, or you go to your boss and say, oh, look, I've got 200,000 followers. You know, maybe I deserve a raise.
Okay, yeah.
Or maybe a column in the newspaper or something like that.
Right, so they pursue that. I know. It's
a sign of the times.
It is a sign of the times. Boy, I hate to say this because it sounds cliche, but you just don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know where that will end.
Well, I mean, it's part of this new virtual reality world that we kind of live in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just very, very strange. Well, I see that.
Oh, us old guys here.
Yes, that's right.
Lamenting.
Get off my lawn, please. Well, I see that the weather is going to be back to kind of more normal.
With snow showers in the forecast. We emphasize snow showers today, tonight, and tomorrow. But partly sunny. It's a beautiful morning out there right now. 32 at O'Hare, unless that has changed. Yes, 32 at O'Hare, 34 at the lakefront, expecting a high in the mid-30s today. Some snow showers, but other than that, partly sunny. The snow showers will continue into tonight and somewhat tomorrow, but showers being the operative word. We're not looking at any accumulation here.
Yeah, nothing like we started last week off with.
Right.
Which
yeah. You know, last week, just to refresh our memories, Dean had Mike Hamernick on, who mm-hmm. he does every Sunday morning, and Mike was talking about the fact that while it may seem more likely that we've had a fair amount of snow this winter thus far, more in some places than others. O'Hare has only had about 9-something inches of measurable snowfall, the official total. Go over to LaPorte, Indiana, it's been over 90, close to 100. That lake effect snow
yeah.
that has just pounded LaPorte County and Berrien County in southwest Michigan. Wow.
Well, and I also believe I saw something, and it might have been from Mike Hamernick, too, is that, so in this January, we'll have had, like, 5 days in where the temperature hit 50.
Something like that. And we hit 50 the other day.
In 5 days.
No complaints from this boy.
In 5 days where the temperature hit zero.
And 5 days where the temperature hit zero. So talk about extremes in 1 month. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, and it truly, Friday was gorgeous out. And Saturday turned out to be just as nice, which
yesterday was fine. Yeah.
And of course the nice weather brings out the Johnny Six note again, and although the winds were such that it knocked over his bucket and he went chasing the couple of singles that were
$2.28
that were flowing down Michigan Avenue.
So he had to leave his zone to go
get his
money.
Get out of his zone. It was pretty it was quite a sight. It was quite a sight.
We need to have him. No, I guess we need not have him on the program.
No, we do not need to have him on the program. No.
I think people would like to know who this person is.
Well, maybe I'll pick up some. I'll bring my recorder down and pick up some sound and just give everybody a sample.
We can do that.
Except
then he'll claim royalties, though.
No, except people might listen and then turn off the show.
That's possible. Also, you don't want that. You don't want that, right?
Well, and as I told Dave off the air last night, I saw Darkest Hour last night.
An excellent movie.
Gary Oldman is he has to. I haven't seen any of the other movies that are for Best Actor, but he's got to get that. I mean, that is just when you're watching it, you're not watching an actor. You're literally like watching Winston Churchill in his first month as Prime Minister of England.
Yeah, the speeches, by the way, if you've seen the movie, or if you haven't seen the movie, you know, you've seen clips on trailers and so forth. The speeches are for real. That's not in the script. Those are taken from the actual addresses from Parliament that he gave at that time. So, you know what I like about movies like this also, Rick, is that it just reminds us of great people and what you can do, and reminds us about certain areas of history that we may have forgotten about or may not have paid much attention to.
No, the history is fantastic, and the cinematography is fantastic. And this isn't a war movie.
There's no battle scenes or anything like that.
This is about everything going on in Great Britain as they're getting dragged further and further into war. And what I liked about it too, the cinematography is great, but it was also done in kind of like a sepia tone. I mean, it's color, but it's done in a sepia tone that really kind of encapsulates kind of the darkness of what's going on.
Sure, especially in some of the scenes where they're, you know, underground in the secret quarters there, strategizing.
It's just, yeah.
And now we're giving a lot of it away.
No, we're not. I mean, it's not like we don't know what happens.
Yeah, right.
You know, but it's going to be amazing. Going to be amazing to see what happens in the Oscars with that. But,
yep.
And then the Grammys are tonight.
Grammys are tonight.
I'm sure Dean's going to have a whole lot about the Grammys tonight.
Cause yes, indeed.
Unfortunately, I can't help you on that one. That's not on my list. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Producer Cassara's here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is taking out his 78s to see what might be Grammy eligible among those. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast on iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Someone sent in a text asking if the NHL All-Star Game will be on WGN Radio today. No, it won't. And actually, I'm not even sure what time the All-Star Game is today. It's not really one of my things. I watched maybe about 5 minutes of the skills competition last night, but you know, it's something on a Sunday, but I I tend to think of it not so much as real hockey. I mean, it's a great honor for all of those athletes that were named to the All-Star team, but it's I don't know. It's the All-Star games these days. It's not like when we were kids and they, you know, there was a pride in the sport kind of thing. Now it's more about kind of like the NFL Pro Bowl, where you don't see necessarily a lot of the players because they don't want to get injured and mess up the contracts that they've got. So, but I'll take a look later and see what time the NHL All-Star Game is on. But no, it will not be here on WGN Radio. Well, up ahead on the Sunday Spin, after we catch up with the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak to Republican State Representative David McSweeney of Barrington Hills. He's backing Republican State Representative Jeannie Ives in her challenge to Governor Bruce Rauner, and we'll talk about the governor's race. After the news and sports at the top of the hour, we'll continue our series of interviews with some of the Democrats vying for the nomination for Illinois Attorney General. After the 8 o'clock news, we'll speak to Sharon Fairley. She's a former federal prosecutor who led the restructuring of the police oversight system into the new civilian Office of Police Accountability. And then after the 8:30 news, we'll be speaking to another candidate, Renato Mariotti. He's a former federal prosecutor. So that's all up ahead on the Sunday Spin. But right now, we're going to start with our weekly spin through national politics. Ahead of President Trump's first State of the Union speech on Tuesday night, last weekend, remember, we were in the midst of a government shutdown. Well, we've got a short-term federal budget, but Democrats gave up on the linkage to dealing with the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals program. Now, as we said last week, there had been an apparent deal in sight with Democrats agreeing to funding for President Trump's wall, but later Trump turned the deal down. So now, Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer says that because of those failed talks, President Trump's wall is off the table for negotiations.
That was part of a package. It was the first thing the president and I talked about was finishing it by, as he said, Tuesday night, 3 days. And the thought was that we could come to an agreement that afternoon, the president would announce his support, and then the Senate and House would get it done and it would be on the president's desk. He didn't do that. So we're going to have to start on a new basis, and the wall offer is off the table.
That's Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer. Now, Trump says, on the other hand, that he's laid out his conditions for a deal, and he says it's very simple. No wall, no DACA. But should those dreamers be concerned about deportation beginning in March when DACA expires? Well, the president says no.
Well, I can tell you this. If you don't have a war, you don't have DACA.
Are you going to invite Schumer back to the White House?
Sure.
Immigration?
Should these dreamers be concerned that they could be deported on March 5th if a deal is not reached?
I tell them not to be concerned, okay?
Mr. President,
tell them not to worry. You wouldn't solve the problem. It's up to the Democrats, but they should not be concerned.
Now, $25 million.
We're going to put it in a fund. $25 billion in a fund.
But you need it all up front. All
we have $25 billion for a wall. We have $5 billion for other security measures.
That's President Donald Trump. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. Just an advisory, the NHL All-Star Game is at 2:30 this afternoon, even though we will not be carrying it here on WGN. But 2:30, they play in a divisional format for an hour, and then the two winners of those divisions play for one final kind of game. So, as I said, not my cup of tea, but you know, honors to the all-star athletes in the NHL. Joining me now on the phone is Republican State Representative David McSweeney of the 57th District. He's from Barrington Hills, Republican. And Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. That was a good Blackhawks victory on Thursday night. Even though we're in the cellar right now, I feel that was a good win before the All-Star break.
Yeah, we still have a couple of games in hand compared to some of the other teams, but we still have a lot of work to do. And I hope we can continue it. What irritated me, the other night, the Hawks win 5-1 against Detroit in Detroit. Of course, it was the Sunday before I went to see the Hawks play Detroit, and they lose 4-0 at home. So why couldn't they have done that when I went to the game? That was my question.
Well, we still have a lot of season left, and hopefully go to a couple more games, Rick. I mean, get in at least barely make it in the playoffs, and then who knows what could happen from there.
I don't know if I want to go to any more games. I might be the bad luck charm if that's the case. Well,
I think we're going to make the playoffs, Rick.
Okay, we'll see. We'll see. I'm not so sure, but I appreciate your optimism. Because I always think of optimism when I talk to you, Representative. Because there's...
Well, I appreciate that, Rick. And in Springfield, unfortunately, there's not a lot of optimism that people can look to this year. But we need to do our jobs and need to focus on what the people of the state want, which is to reform spending and get rid of some of these taxes. But thanks for having me on.
Well, there's so many things to talk about. I mean, so much in the news. I mean, last week, for example, Comptroller Susan Mendoza notes that the state, through its budget stalemate, incurred over $1 billion in late interest penalties for not having a budget, for not paying its bills on time. And that's $1 billion. I mean, that's $1 billion that's just right out the window.
You could take that money and take it out on Michigan Avenue and just burn it, and it would have the same impact then. And that was one of the biggest mistakes that Governor Rauner made, is not focusing on a budget day one, a budget that would actually cut spending. And, of course, we need economic growth, and I support workers' compensation reform. Of course, we need to cut property taxes. But all that happened is we incurred $1 billion of late interest penalties. The $16 billion unpaid bill balance peaked out, and then we just issued more debt. So when people talk about the $8 billion unpaid bill balance now, we didn't reduce the overall debt. We just refinanced it at a lower interest rate. And I was a strong supporter. I worked very closely with Comptroller Mendoza on the bill to actually require transparency. And the governor vetoed that bill. We overrode him 112-0 in the House because we want the information. So we not only have $1 billion late interest penalties that we have incurred, but we also have $2.3 billion that was spent last year that was not appropriated. So that's another big problem that needs to be addressed, and I think that Debt Transparency Act is just a start so we can get the information so we can focus on spending.
And nobody's really explained where that $2.3 billion that was not appropriated by the legislature, how it got spent.
Well, two areas. One is group health insurance, the health insurance for state employees. Since the governor's come in, there's been no reforms on that, and it's been a problem for years even before his time. And then he spent money from the Department of Corrections that wasn't appropriated. And my biggest issue is that was not publicly disclosed until the bond offering by the state of Illinois was required by law in October. So we went from the end of June until October without knowing that we spent $2.3 billion that wasn't even appropriated, in addition to all the other debt that we have in this state. And that's a number one point. I mean, we're going to hear a lot of political rhetoric, I'm sure, in the state of the state this speech this Wednesday. I want to hear a detailed plan. What is the governor going to do about the $2.3 billion of money that was not appropriated? I'm looking for a detailed plan, and we need to cut spending in the state.
Well, and you mentioned the State of the State speech coming up, and of course, that's kind of the predicate to a state budget address in which the governor says that he's going to propose a balanced budget, that he's going to propose phasing down the income tax increase, but he has not really ever proposed a balanced budget. And,
no, he hasn't. And I think that's one thing that we need to see, a detailed plan. And the first year he came close, He was still off by $2 billion because his pension bill would not have realized the savings, plus it was unconstitutional. And the other 2 years, he just phoned it in. He said that we're going to rely on some kind of grand bargain. Remember, the grand bargain was a tax hike. That's what he was talking about. That was just a code phrase for I'm going to raise taxes. So when I hear the governor talking about the tax increase, and as you know, I strongly opposed increasing the income tax rate by 32%. The governor had been talking about that for a couple of years. That was a big tactical mistake, I believe, in not focusing on the budget. The governor has enormous powers in the state of Illinois to actually not spend money. Just because the money is available doesn't mean that he has to spend it. But I'm looking for a detailed plan. The governor signed that Chicago pensions education bill. I called a bailout for Chicago pensions because it provided even more money than he wanted when he was criticizing the bill. So we need to hear a detailed plan on how he's going to cut spending and how we're going to roll back these tax increases immediately.
Do you expect to see one?
We better. We're certainly not going to see it on Wednesday.
Yes.
Well, given the track record, I wouldn't bet a lot of money because he hasn't proposed a balanced budget in the last few years. So that said, he should be held accountable if he does not propose a balanced budget as required on February 14th. And there better not just be a line that says, compromise, because in Springfield, compromise over the last few years has been, again, a code phrase for raising taxes. I mean, the real story, Rick, and you know this, is the money is in pensions and Medicaid. And in pensions, nothing's been done over the last few years, and we have to address that point. If President Cullerton has some ideas on reducing the 3% compounded cost of living adjustments in the future that I believe are constitutional. We can move people to 401ks. We've talked about this many times. We can reamortize the pension debt. And on Medicaid, that is an area that not only do we need to reform, but we need to have better accountability. There was a story last week, as you know, that the Auditor General did a report that said the administration had not properly monitored $7 billion of expenditure. So we need to completely reform Medicaid while protecting the needy in the state, but we need to reform those two big programs. That's where the money is.
So we've spoken about the governor's obligation in presenting a budget, but do you have any belief that the Democrats that control the legislature want to see a budget, particularly as we're in this, superheated election season?
Well, it's all about politics, unfortunately, right now, so the answer is probably not, and that's a disgrace, because we have over $200 billion of debt in this state. We have people who are leaving. We're now behind Pennsylvania in population. We're number six now. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with the tax burden in this state, with all the liabilities we're facing, the uncertainty that businesses face when they move into the state. So we should do our jobs, but it's a political year. I saw the Democrats watch that debate last week, and they're in an intense competition, Rick, to tell us who's going to raise taxes the highest. That's what it seems the competition is. I respect Senator Biss. Have a good relationship with him, even though I disagree with him on a lot. J.B. Pritzker and Chris Kennedy are all competing. Their answer is who's going to raise taxes, who's going to adopt the progressive income tax. That's not the answer, and I hope that the leadership in the General Assembly realizes that the people of the state have had enough of these taxes.
But isn't there a way to do a graduated income tax that could be done in a fair way, in your mind?
I don't think so, Rick, because one of the things we've seen and experienced in other states is that even when the initial rates are adopted, that the rates are always raised. And you see states like Connecticut and New Jersey that are losing people. And as you know, to approve a constitutional amendment in this state for a progressive income tax, they don't have the rates in it. All they do is say that you go from the flat rate right now of 4.95% to a graduated rate. So when people would vote to change the tax system, they wouldn't know the tax rates. That's one of the other big issues and the big problems. And again, we are losing people in this state every day, I believe, because of high income taxes and high property taxes together, the combined burden, and you throw in the sales tax burden in the state. So I think it would be a disaster.
We're speaking with Republican State Representative David McSweeney of Barrington Hills. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back. back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. I'm speaking with Representative David McSweeney, Republican from Barrington Hills. Representative, as I've said, you're a supporter of Republican State Representative Jeannie Ives' challenge to Governor Rauner in the Republican primary. Last week she announced that, maybe a half dozen or so of your colleagues in the House also are supporting her candidacy. What does that say about the positioning of Bruce Rauner right now?
I think he has a big problem. I think he needs to explain to the people of the state of Illinois why he hasn't proposed a balanced budget, why we ended up with a tax hike. We had 71 Democrats and Pat Quinn as governor of the state, and we didn't have a tax hike. Under Bruce Rauner, we ended up with a massive tax increase. He promised to get us to a 3% income tax rate, and we're at 4.95%. And, of course, he signed a bill last year, HB 40, that we've talked about many times, that that provides for taxpayer funding of abortions with no limitations. And Henry Hyde, as you know, is from Illinois and destroyed his legacy. And it's also a situation that this is a governor who won't even mention the President of the United States. He won't say President Trump's name. So he has a lot of explaining to do, and there are ways I think that he could actually work with the administration. We talked about Medicaid. There's actually right now a complete rewrite of the hospital assessment tax going on.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that is, and we've spoken about it on the show before, but this is actually becoming a very, very serious issue about the future of funding these safety net hospitals in throughout the state.
And it sure is. And not only is it the funding of the safety net to hospitals, which, of course, we need to maintain, but it's the split of federal funding. And, Greg Harris is a Democrat. I have a lot of respect. I disagree with him on many issues. But he has had many very innovative ideas over the last few years about ways to bring in more federal money. And you're dealing with the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. This would be a perfect opportunity for Governor Rauner to meet with President Trump and to actually try to get more federal money for the state of Illinois. We need to look at all options. I have no problem fighting hard for Illinois. We have two senators who claim they want to get more money, and we have a Republican delegation that's committed to the same thing. So, during this hospital assessment tax, which again is rewriting the way that funding of Medicaid occurs in this state, it's very, very significant. We could see an announcement or a compromise on that over the next couple of weeks. This is another example that because Governor Rauner won't even say President Trump's name, won't even meet with them, that we could get shortchanged.
Well, and to do this hospital assessment, this tax on hospitals that helps helps generate money for federal funding for health care, that's a waiver process. If you don't know somebody in the administration, and waivers take a long time to accomplish.
And the administration has said very clearly that they want states to come in with waivers. They want states to come up with innovative programs, and many other governors of other states are pursuing those to save money, to actually improve care in a lot of cases. But to have a basic relationship with the President of the United States, especially as a Republican governor, would be a positive thing. But as you know, I think you were the first person to report it. Remember, Governor Rauner wouldn't even endorse the Republican nominee for president at that point. They made a big deal about that. So when he won't even say the president's name, you won't endorse him against a Democrat, I think that hurts the state as a Republican governor. And we're seeing that, I think, with this hospital assessment tax. We're seeing this in this mess overall in Medicaid, with the audit showed on monitoring. We should be working very, very closely with the federal government to make sure we have proper controls in place and that we're getting not only our fair share, but that we're getting more federal money for the state of Illinois.
Another issue that came up last week was the kind of details from an unsealing of a lawsuit from a business partner of the governor, saying that in a dispute over an investment, how they met at the governor's mansion to talk this over. even though the governor has claimed that all of his finances are in a blind trust, which we know was never really a blind trust. It was a power of attorney, as we reported in the Tribune. But the fact that every question dealing about his business, and which he still generates substantial income from, the answer is, well, it's on blind trust. I don't know what's going on. And then we find out that, well, actually, he was in negotiations with a business partner over a dispute. Here, questions again about transparency.
Well, the strangest part of that whole situation is it looks from, I've read a lot about the whole situation, it appears that he actually has a case to go to arbitration in this business deal. So let's put that aside. The issue is, though, why at a press conference just a couple months ago did he deny he knew anything about it? That's my issue, is on transparency. The governor could have just said, I have the power of attorney. I'm not involved in this. However, there is this one case that goes back before I was governor, and I'm dealing with it. That would have been a much better answer. It wouldn't have been the story. The story is really the cover-up here, in my view, and the cover-up being, you know, his denial that he knew anything about it. That's the strange thing about it, is it appears that his case is legitimate, that it should go through our arbitration. It appears that for a lot of his investments, that of course he's using the power of attorney properly. If he had just simply answered the question and said that he's dealing with this situation, I don't think it would have been an issue at all. But now the issue is, why did he tell everybody he knew nothing about it?
Well, and are there other instances?
And that's what we need to find out. In fact, you know, you've got a mess on both sides. You've got a mess, obviously, right now with the governor needing to explain his comments a couple months ago. And there's a lot of focus on J.B. Pritzker's finances at this point. And so I think we're going to be dealing with a situation here before the primary that the voters are going to be demanding answers from all politicians about exactly if there are conflicts of interest and where things stand.
We talk a lot about the mood of the electorate, and, you know, here we are less than 2 months away from the primary, and obviously, you know, the Democratic, a big field for governor, big field for attorney general, some big fields for congressional races out there. And we'll see what the kind of the temperature spirit is among Democrats. But I guess I'm kind of curious, what is the enthusiasm quotient for Republicans?
Well, I think all citizens of this state, I think, are concerned about the future. And what I hear most is that people want to leave the state because they're concerned about high taxation. They're concerned about what's going on in Springfield. And specifically on the Republican base, they're very concerned about what the future of the state is. There's a lot of people are losing hope. And when I talk to people not only in my district but throughout the state, they want to see a positive plan. I mean, the national economy is booming right now, right? We're at 4.1% unemployment. We have 2.6% growth in GDP, and it should go to, you know, 3%. There's a lot overall positive, but in the state of Illinois, we're lagging and we're falling behind. And specifically, the biggest issue I hear about from my constituents over and over again is that they're sick and tired of high property taxes. They want to see local governments consolidated. They want to see property taxes cut. I think that's the number one issue right now.
And I would agree with you. And of course, obviously, with the focus that's been raised on issues like the fairness of the property assessment system and things like that. Since the bulk of property taxes go to schools, the only way to take some of that pressure off is to have the state pick up the slack, isn't it? And that would
be... I think the biggest way we can cut property taxes, Rick, and that's one of the things I'm focusing on right now with a couple of bills, too, is to consolidate local governments. That's the biggest issue. Until we consolidate the 7,000 units of local government, until we start eliminating townships with voter approval that don't make sense, until we start allowing consolidation that makes sense with the school districts, we're going to have a big problem. So consolidation allows administrative costs to be cut. And it allows fundamental change. I think that's the key, is start reducing and eliminating layers of unnecessary local governments here in the state of Illinois. Cut administrative costs. That's the key to lower property taxes.
And how do you encourage that?
Well, it's specifically by voter approval. I mean, what I have done is I filed a number of bills, but the one I'm focused on specifically right now is to allow voter approval just to eliminate a township by a majority vote, to allow citizens to put that on the ballot and vote on it. I think that's the best way to start and to be able to do that eventually for all units of government, you know, a different mechanism, but to encourage consolidation is absolutely key. I mean, DuPage County, they started the process, then a little bit in Lake, a little bit in McHenry now, but not enough. Property taxes are still high. I think encouraging citizen participation and allowing citizens to decide whether to eliminate some of these units of government is the best way to do it.
That's Representative David McSweeney. He's a Republican from Barrington Hills. Representative, as always, thank you so much for joining me on the Sunday Spin.
Thank you, Rick.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome to the second hour of the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Last week, the president made an unscheduled visit to his chief of staff's office where there was a briefing with reporters. The president says he'll find out if he will be treated fairly by special counsel Robert Mueller. This, of course, was before the New York Times reported that Trump wanted to fire Mueller and stopped when his White House counsel threatened to quit. This is the president.
There's no collusion.
What is that?
Now they're saying, oh, well, did he fight back?
But what is that? What is collusion? So what does no collusion
back
mean?
Yeah. Fight back. Oh, it's obstruction. So here's the thing. I hope so.
So how do you define collusion? And Maggie asked this earlier during the briefing to Sarah.
How are you going to define it for me, okay? But I can tell you, there's no collusion. I couldn't have cared less about Russians having to do with my campaign. The fact is, you people won't say this, but I'll say it. I was a much better candidate than her. You always say she was a bad candidate. You never say I was a good candidate. I was one of the greatest candidates. Nobody else would have beaten the Clinton machine, as crooked as it was. But I was a great candidate. Someday you're going to say that. Goodbye, everybody.
Also, last week, there was another school shooting, this time in Kentucky. It's the 11th school shooting already in this new year. ABC reporter Peter Alexander asked the White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, about what the White House is doing about school shootings. Instead, she accused the reporter of saying Trump was complicit in a school shooting.
We agree we don't want
crime. I think they're part of a crime wave, absolutely. I don't think you can completely separate the two. They are a part of domestic violence, and I think that it certainly would be part of a crime wave that we are focused on addressing, and you can see some of the things that we've done since taking off.
For the nation and tell Americans how he feels about this issue and try to do what he can with the bully pulpit.
I think he has, Peter. I mean, to sit there and question, I'm sorry, hold on. I was polite and let you finish, but let me be very clear on this. The fact that you're basically accusing the president of being complicit in a school shooting is outrageous.
It's his advertisement that accuses the Democrats of being complicit on a different topic. I'm not accusing the president of anything.
Ignoring the fact that the safety and security of our borders is very different. The president has been very clear and instructed the top law enforcement agency in this country to crack down on crime and to do everything they can to prevent these types of things. We've talked about it here numerous times, and we're going to continue moving forward in that process. Thanks, guys.
So we'll talk about it numerous times. We'll talk about it. Joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Sharon Fairley. She is one of the Democratic candidates for Attorney General. Most recently, she led the restructuring of the Civilian Office of Police Accountability. Sharon, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
One of the things I've asked the candidates to come in, because obviously attention tends to flow to the Democratic race for governor and now Republican race for governor, and we have this big field, and I wanted the candidates to, one, say, why do you want to run for attorney general? What is there about this job of attorney general, given your background, that you want to seek this office?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I really appreciate your bringing attention to this race, because the position is just so incredibly important to our state, and more important than ever before. I entered this race because I'm just really concerned about the situation that our state faces right now. And I really believe that our political leadership has failed to deliver and solve the problems that our state faces. And we're just left in this kind of never-ending political quagmire, and we're not making any progress. And so I really believe that in this particular office, we need someone who has the experience and independence to really lead our state into a new future. And I believe that I have a very unique combination of skills and experiences to bring to the office that is what the office actually needs right now. So, I have the legal expertise, I have the analytical expertise, I have the management expertise. I've actually already led an agency that's responsible for complex legal matters successfully. And so I believe that I have the proven competence to do the job. And so that's why I'm in it.
Why don't you give us a little bit about your background?
Sure. Yeah. So I was born in Washington, D.C. and raised by two public servants who both worked in education. And so I grew up with a core family value of public service and the importance of a proper functioning government. I got my undergraduate degree from Princeton in mechanical and aerospace engineering, which shows that I have the courage to stand up to tough problems and attack tough problems. I got an MBA from the Wharton School, and then I had a business career and was very successful. So I've learned how to manage people and processes and budgets. But at the end of the day, I reached a point in my life that I really wanted to focus on public service. So I went to law school with the idea that I would commit my professional life to serving the public, and that's what I've done. So I got my law degree from the University of Chicago, and ever since then I've only represented the citizens of Illinois and been delighted and privileged to do so. I first served as an assistant attorney general and in the criminal appeals area, and then I served as a federal prosecutor for 8 years working on the kinds of cases and investigations that are really directly relevant to the office of the attorney general. And then, of course, as you mentioned, for the last couple of years, I worked for the city of Chicago, first as the first deputy inspector general at the city agency responsible for rooting out government corruption and waste, and then as the chief administrator of the Independent Police Review Authority and the Civilian Office of Police Accountability. And it was in that capacity that, you know, I really worked hard to push for change, and I believe that I proved that I can be independent and be successful in getting things done in the rough and tumble world of Illinois politics. So I really believe that this personal and professional background really makes me uniquely qualified for the job in a way that other candidates in the race just aren't.
You mentioned that in serving as a federal prosecutor, that there seems like a relationship there to what you would be doing as attorney general.
Yes, sir.
Could you flesh that out for me
a
little bit?
Sure, absolutely. So my experience at the U.S. Attorney's Office here was really, really quite broad, and I think that's important because it's different even than the other federal prosecutors in this race. So I worked on narcotics trafficking cases, which gives me an insight into the opioid crisis. I worked on firearms trafficking cases, which gives me insight into our gun violence problems. I also worked on complex fraud matters, which is directly relevant to the office's responsibilities in the area of consumer protection. I worked on national security matters, counterintelligence, and counterespionage, which gives me expertise and experience on, for example, privacy protection. So there's a lot of work that I've done that is directly relevant to the work. So it's also in that capacity you have experience doing complex litigation, which is really important to the office because, again, the Attorney General is responsible for litigating matters on behalf of the state and behalf of the people of the state. But also what's more important is the investigative skills that you gain as being a federal prosecutor. So I've learned how to investigate those kinds of matters, which is really relevant to the enforcement work of the Attorney General, not just the criminal side, but also in the civil side. So, for example, one of the cases that I prosecuted at the office was a group of individuals that was defrauding homeowners by telling them if they gave them a large fee of $2,500, that they would then convince their bank to modify their mortgage and lower their mortgage payment. And they really preyed on older homeowners, and it was really tragic because they would tell them, stop paying your mortgage, because that would show the bank that you were having difficulty paying your mortgage. Those individuals were first operating out of storefronts, and they were sued by the city of Chicago to get them to stop. They were then sued by the attorney general to get them to stop, but they didn't stop. They went underground, and they started using aliases and operating out of their homes. So working with law enforcement, I found them and brought them to justice, and that's because I have the skills, the investigative skills and expertise to do that kind of work, and that's directly relevant to the work of the Office of the Attorney General.
We're speaking with Sharon Fairley. She's a Democratic candidate for attorney general. I'm Rick Pearson. This is The Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Showcase studio with Sharon Farrelly. She's one of the Democratic candidates for Attorney General as we continue our series of discussions with those candidates. Sharon, one of the things that seems to be a commonality among all of the candidates is taking on Donald Trump. And I understand that part of the issue, and of course there's no shortage of things that the Democrats would challenge Donald Trump on, but there's also the duties of Attorney General that relates more directly to the people of the state of Illinois. Is there a balancing act here?
So I see them as actually being one and the same. Excuse me. And the reason is this: there are certain policies that are being pursued by the Trump administration that actually have a direct and negative impact on the citizens of Illinois. And you can look at it on almost any of the areas that we want to fight back against Trump on. Let's just start with immigration, right? The whole DACA movement, right? These are individuals that are now here in Illinois and contributing to our life and our economic prosperity here. And so by losing them, it would have a negative impact on our economy and our life and our well-being. Let's take health care, right? When the Trump administration seeks to roll back federal benefits in the area of health care, those are then costs that are going to come right back to us here in Illinois. When people don't have health care, then they go to emergency rooms, and hospitals end up paying those costs, and those costs end up getting transferred to the other consumers here in Illinois. That's the same way with rolling back, for example, the coverage of contraception for women. Again, when that federal benefit, when those benefits are taken away, somebody else is going to have to pay the costs, and that cost is going to come back to us in Illinois, either to cover the contraceptive benefit or to pay the health care costs that are associated with people who don't have contraception. The environment. We have communities in Waukegan that are really suffering because the failure of the EPA to enforce its EPA rules in terms of petcoke, right? There are communities where a third of the children have asthma or asthma-like symptoms because of the petcoke that's being distributed throughout their community. So these are the issues that have real impact on our state. So I see them as part of the consumer protection responsibility of the agency. As much as I really loathe the racist policies, you know, just in general. And I take some of it personally, right? For example, the idea that he wants to attack affirmative action, I take that personally. But it really is, I see it as part and parcel to the role of the Attorney General in protecting the citizens of Illinois from harmful policies, whether it's government or it's abusive and exploitive businesses.
We've had Lisa Madigan in that office for some time, and I know it kind of caught everybody by surprise when she decided that she was not seeking re-election. But is there some area that you might highlight that in a different way that she has not, in your opinion, gone far enough?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, there are really two, for me, there are two areas that I believe that the office can play a much more strategic and proactive role. The first is in the area of public safety. And in that area, we're talking about, you know, the idea that we have a problem here in terms of the lack of trust between law enforcement and the communities that they serve. And this is a statewide issue. I know we're here in Chicago right now focused on this issue. We have a police department that is under scrutiny, and thankfully Lisa Madigan took the important step of filling the void left by the Trump administration by filing the lawsuit seeking court oversight of the reforms of the Chicago Police Department. But this is an issue statewide, and we need to work on these issues statewide. We also need to work on smarter criminal justice reform, and I believe the Attorney General can play a bigger and more important role in that area. And then, of course, the second area is in government integrity and transparency, and this is where I believe that the office really needs to step in a big way. There are a lot of problems here with holding our political actors accountable at all levels of government. We all know that we learned last fall that we went for 3 years without a legislative inspector general. I particularly found that unconscionable, trying to figure out who was responsible for making sure that position was filled. And I'm currently concerned because As I understand that the current person in the role is only temporary, and that I don't see any actions going on or actions being taken to find and place a permanent person in that role. So after June 30th, you know, are we going to have a permanent person and a well-stocked office, a well-hired office, filled office to fill that role? And these are things that the Attorney General can and should be working on.
What about as far as the issue of public corruption?
Absolutely. So this is really important. I think, you know, I've actually put out on my website a platform of ideas that I'd like, some of the ideas that I'd like to pursue when the job. But first and foremost is, you know, I would like to form a statewide task force to coordinate between the state's attorney's office and the law enforcement agencies to make sure that they are sharing resources and information and that there's expertise and political will throughout the state to prosecute these kinds of cases. I'd also like to work on developing policies and protocols for the local governments, because not all of them can have, for example, an inspector general office by themselves. And so what are the checks and balances that they can put in place to ensure that their political actors can be held to, accountable? These are some of the things that I'd like to be working on. But I believe that the office should be playing a much more involved role in that area.
What about, I mean, some have talked, even going so far as the idea of statewide grand juries under the authority.
Then. Absolutely, absolutely. I think that, you know, for too long we've kind of relied on the federal government to do a lot of the work in the area of political corruption. And I know that the new U.S. attorney has said that, you know, he's going to really be focusing on political corruption for the office here in the Northern District of Illinois. And that's terrific. But, you know, those resources are limited, and we cannot just rely on them completely to hold our government accountable. And so we need to develop our own infrastructure, checks and balances within the state to make sure that we can do that ourselves.
Does the Attorney General's office liaison enough with the U.S. Attorney's office? One of the reasons I ask you are things like, you know, the gun flow coming from Indiana and other states, those kinds of things. Obviously, the Justice Department has its own,
right,
you know, priorities, but that's still seems to be, you know, a very significant issue here.
Absolutely. I believe that the office can play a bigger role when it comes to the enforcement of and dealing with the gun violence issue. And this is a tough problem, right? There isn't one solution.
Right.
So, it's got to be solved by, you know, a combination of law enforcement and then community engagement and community involvement. So when it comes to the laws, I mean, I want to advocate for just getting the Gun Dealer Licensing Act done. We just need to get that done. Because we know that 40% of the illegal guns that are found related to crimes actually come from Illinois. And so we need to, and in order to stem that piece of legislation is going to be very helpful. And we know that. The second thing is we need to continue to push for stronger federal gun regulation, because we know that Illinois is kind of an island. We're surrounded by other states whose gun laws are not as strong as ours, and we have, again, 60% of the guns coming in from other states. And again, as a federal prosecutor, I have direct experience of that. One of the cases that I last prosecuted at the office was a group of individuals who were bringing guns in from Indiana into Chicago, selling the guns, using the proceeds to buy heroin, and then taking it back to a small town in Ohio called Marion, Ohio, where they just really decimated that community with opioid addiction. And then they would sell the heroin and get more money and buy more guns. And it was this vicious circle that they were doing. And so, you know, I have experience using law to enforce that kind of activity. And I'd like to work more proactively with law enforcement and the state's attorneys across the state to improve the level of enforcement that we're seeing that we're able to achieve.
Sharon, for more information about your campaign, people
yes.
can go to
SharonFairley.com.
Spell it.
SharonFairley.com. Thank you so much.
Sharon, thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
I've been delighted to. Thank you.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland last week, President Trump spoke once again about the media, and he got some boos from the crowd when he used his favorite term, fake news.
I've always seemed to get, for whatever reason, a disproportionate amount of press or media, and throughout my whole life, somebody will explain someday why, but I've always gotten a lot. And as a businessman, I was always treated really well by the press. You know, the numbers speak and things happen, but I've always really had a very good press. And it wasn't until I became a politician that I realized how nasty, how mean, how vicious, and how fake the press can be as the cameras start going off in the back. But overall, I mean, the bottom line, somebody said, well, they couldn't have been that bad because here we are, we're president, and I think we're doing a really great job.
So there's fake media being called out by Trump, but I'd like you to listen to the words of Angela Povilaitis. Now, who is she? She's an assistant attorney general in Michigan. She prosecuted USA Gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar, who was sentenced to 175 years in prison last week for sexually assaulting more than 140 women. This is what Povilaitis had to say about journalism.
We as a society need investigative journalists more than ever. What finally started this reckoning and ended this decades-long cycle of abuse was investigative reporting. Without that first Indianapolis Star story in August of 2016, without the story where Rachel came forward publicly shortly thereafter, he would still be practicing medicine, treating athletes and abusing kids. Let that sink in for a minute. Right now, he would be at his office on Hagedorn and Hannah, not far from this courtroom in the Michigan State University campus, abusing children, had it not been for the investigative reporters and Rachel, who brought this case. We know federal law enforcement did not stop him, nor did trainers or coaches or deans or medical supervisors. Victim disclosures to adults didn't stop him. Reporters began the story in excellent, victim-centered, offender-focused police and prosecutors grabbed the baton and brought us here today.
That's Assistant Attorney General for the state of Michigan, Angela Povilaitis. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Renato Mariotta. He is another one of the Democratic candidates for Attorney General. Renato, thank you so much for joining me, and I hope I didn't take you away from a cable news appearance.
Oh, gosh.
That's where I seem to find you.
Well, not as much now. I've been focused on the race, and, you know, I'm one of these people, you know, I think there's people who run for office who had nothing else going on, obviously, between a busy law practice and doing that stuff. I was pretty busy before this, but I thought that was a public service. I just heard a moment ago you had journalists, you were talking about the work of journalists. I think explaining things to the public about what's going on is a value too.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. I was born in Chicago. My parents didn't go to college. My dad didn't even graduate from high school. My parents both worked two jobs to put me through school. My dad was a barber during the day and delivered papers at night. My mom worked at the local insurance agent during the day answering the phones, and then she sewed crafts at night. I went to the University of Chicago and Yale Law School with some scholarships. Then after a stint in private practice, I became a federal prosecutor here in Chicago. Pat Fitzgerald hired me, and I did that for almost a decade. I am 41 now. I left the U.S. Attorney's Office a little over a year and a half ago after some tough trials and a bout with cancer, which I was fortunate to defeat. And I thought I was going to be slowing down. And as you point out, I started talking on television, in op-eds, on social media, and I ultimately decided to throw my hat in the ring when Lisa Madigan decided not to run. I thought it was an opportunity to do something of value for the state.
What drove you to that decision about seeking this office?
You know, this is not, in my view, not an ordinary time. I mean, here you have the President of the United States just a moment ago was attacking our free press, which is a disgrace, by the way, because that's, I think, a cornerstone of our democracy. But you have him attacking us on a number of fronts, attacking our constitutional rights, attacking a lot of the things that we hold dear. And, you know, frankly, our state is in a bad spot, too. Obviously, you know, we've talked a lot about, I think, you know, in this state about corruption. It's been a focus of my, it was a focus of the office the entire time I was a federal prosecutor. But we also have problems in this state, unfortunately, with, you know, our budget. Our politicians aren't getting things done down in Springfield. I thought, you know, if this is an opportunity, it almost never opens up. It didn't the entire time I was an adult. Here's an opportunity for a job where I'm an experienced prosecutor and trial lawyer. If people like me aren't going to put themselves up for this job, we're going to end up with another politician.
you mentioned corruption. And it's, yes, it's been a while since the seat has opened up, but every time the seat does open up, there's a, people say we're going to go after public corruption and ultimately say, well, there's only limited things that the Office of Attorney General can do about public corruption. How do you view that office and how it could go after public corruption?
You know, I think it has to be a priority in the state, and it's not even because of the corruption itself. It's because people have lost faith in our government, and that's a problem. And we can't have citizens, and everywhere I go around the state, people are complaining. Democrats are complaining about our own party and our own party leadership. So I think what we have to do is expand our view of what it means to fight corruption. In other words, indictments are fine. I do support expanding the authority of the Attorney General's office, although I don't have a lot of hope for our General Assembly allowing us to do that. But what I do think we need to do is we need to do more investigation, and we need to publish reports and expand the public's knowledge. You know, a moment ago you played that clip, which it was very moving, about how journalists played such an important role of uncovering the sexual assault in Michigan. You know, journalists here at the Tribune have played an important part of uncovering some corrupt practices in our state government. We have to not just rely on journalists to do that. I think it's an important part of the free press, but our Attorney General can shed light, can conduct investigations and shed light on some of these issues as well. And I think bringing things to the public eye, bringing more sunshine and transparency to our state government would do us all a lot of good.
Well, and that's one of the things I've always wondered is, I know that maybe an Attorney General can't directly prosecute in the way that, like in Michigan, in that case, that, you know, but it's like, well, we'd have to refer it to whatever. But there's nothing that would stop any kind of an investigation.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think we need to be doing more of that. And that's, you know, investigation in a public report. You know, one thing that people forget about criminal investigations is that the evidence is secret. So unless it results in a prosecution, nothing comes of it. I talk about criminal investigations sometimes, you know, on television or whatever, and people don't realize the point of a criminal investigation is not to inform the public. It's to generate charges. So when there's something that needs a lot of light shined on it, like our property tax system or perhaps how we're allocating TIF funds or other things that the public is concerned about, I think actually having a non-criminal investigation could be more important because it informs the public so we can throw people out that are part of the problem, or we could reform the system, which I think is often very necessary.
Now, obviously, you've talked a lot about Trump and the special prosecutor Mueller's investigation and through the twists and turns that have occurred. Is there a balance between representing the state against actions of a president versus just representing the people of the state? Is there a balance there?
Yeah, I think that's an important point because, look, what you don't want to do is be filing lawsuits purely with a political agenda. Like, I don't like, you know, sometimes people in the state, politicians in the state have done it. Like, we'll you know, try to have legislation here in the city that is aimed at Trump Tower, aimed at Donald Trump on a personal level. And sometimes that can have a symbolic value, but I think we have so many problems here in the state, we can't spend a lot of energy on that. What we need to be focusing on are the times when the Trump administration is affecting the lives of people in the state, and that's different. You know, if there are people in the state who are being deported or who are having their contraceptive coverage removed from the Affordable Care Act coverage they're getting, that has a real impact on people's lives, and then that's just, to me, that's a health care case, that's an immigration case, that's not a Donald Trump case. Now, that doesn't mean we're not taking on the Trump administration. Obviously, I'm a big critic, and I think we need to be aggressive. But the point is to move people's lives forward, and the reason that I'm so concerned about Donald Trump is I feel like he, for the first time in my lifetime, we have a president who's really trying to undermine some of our core values.
And that's where people need to step up. Like,
exactly,
as attorney,
right,
using the process of law.
Exactly right. And attorney generals across this country have done it, and that's a message that I talk about a lot because I, look, one of my messages, I talk a lot on social media, as you probably know, and one of my messages to people, especially since I talk about Mueller's investigation, is don't sit back and wait for Bob Mueller or somebody far away to save America. Get off your butts and do it yourselves. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to do here, and I think state's attorney generals have an important role, and, you know, for the first time, people people in my party often deride federalism, okay? But for the first time, I think people in our party are seeing the value of having state governments and state attorney generals take action, whether it's for net neutrality or the travel ban. We just had the one-year anniversary of the travel ban yesterday. You know, that is still being litigated. A friend of mine is arguing that case in the Supreme Court soon. You know, that is because the state of Hawaii hired him to fight that. And that's a good thing, I think, for this country, because I don't think we should show the rest of the world that we're discriminating against Muslims.
We're speaking with Renato Mariotti. He's a Democratic candidate for Attorney General. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. Joining me here is Renato Mariotti, one of the Democratic candidates for Attorney General. When you look at Lisa Madigan's record, and obviously everybody, I think, was surprised when she decided not to seek a fifth term. But when you look at her record and look at her work, are there areas that you would highlight differently in the office than what she did?
Yeah, I mean, look, she's done a fine job. I don't, you know, I'm not critical of her, but I think I would have a different approach. I mean, one thing is obviously we've talked a little bit about public corruption. That wasn't a focus of hers. I don't know why, but I think it's something we have to tackle because it has a
It's a cultural effect here.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, it just when I go around and see all these Democrats talking about how they think our leadership's corrupt, that's a problem. We can't have that perception. We need to put a rest to it one way or the other, shine some light on it and figure out what's going on. But I think the other thing you know, that I would say, too, is I think on certain issues I might be more aggressive. I mean, obviously, you know, on some of this litigation we were talking about, whether it's the Affordable Care Act and so on, you know, I'm one of those activist types. It was an Indivisible Chicago, and we were calling, you know, her office, asking her to join that legislation. That litigation. I don't feel like we should be the activists should having to be asking her to join on and sign on to that litigation. She should have been on the forefront of that. I think I might also be a little bit more aggressive, trying to get, you know, go after and get settlements. I mean, she's done some good work on opioids and going after opioid manufacturers. I think I would expand that. And you know, she's been a real hero. I'm an environmental person. She's been a real hero on that front, but I may change our approach and do more cases in federal court and some larger cases on the environmental side as well.
Is part of that because of concerns about what the EPA, the state of the EPA these days?
Well, for sure. You know, that's part of the challenge is because the federal government's doing less, we've got to do more on the state side, and that's unfortunate because we don't have a lot of extra resources. So, you know, really, we have to pick things up. I think the Tribune, that was another thing where the Tribune did some reporting on it, where there's, for example, chromium being dumped in the Lake Michigan. So I think there's a lot of work for us to do.
You mentioned property taxes, mm-hmm. and that seems to be an issue that you know, you even have one candidate for governor saying they view it as a civil rights violation.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to use that kind of heated rhetoric. It's because of maybe who I am. I'm a lawyer, and I'm somebody who tried to be careful with my words. But this is what I'll say. I am really concerned about the property tax system. I think it's unfortunate that it's great that journalists, you know, here, you know, in the Tribune, in this building, uncovered that, but it's unfortunate that we had to rely on journalists to do it. I think there's a lot of very serious questions about our property tax system. Voters deserve to know what's going on. I have endorsed Fritz Kagi, who is a new outsider guy who's got some financial experience, who I think has an opportunity to come in and clean that up. And I'm concerned about it because what it suggests to me is this. People who are insiders who have the money to pay for expensive attorneys are getting a benefit. And a lot of average people like my family, my dad's a cashier at Walmart, would never have that opportunity. And that's wrong. And I think we have a system where, you know, there's also an appearance where people are hiring certain politicians and their law firms and they're getting an even bigger benefit. And that, you know, if that's true, that's a very serious problem. Now, is it a crime? Is it a violation of law? I don't know. I don't prejudge things before I investigate it, but I think we need to shed light on that, and we need a governmental investigation, and we need a report, and hopefully, even if Mr. Kagi wins, and I hope he does, I think we need to do that so that this matter can be put to rest, and hopefully it'll discourage people from doing stuff like this again.
Maybe related to this, What about the issue of conflict of interest when it comes to elected officials? And, I mean, my colleague, Hal Dardig, mentioned a piece in the involving the city council and procedural actions and things like this. I mean, there's this dilemma. I think we want to have, like, a citizen legislature, not necessarily a professional one, but citizen legislature means they have jobs outside.
Yeah.
And are we seeing enough, I guess, exposure to potential conflicts of interest?
I will tell you, I'm new to Illinois politics. This is my first time running for something, and I have seen nothing but conflicts of interest all over the place in my limited experience directly in it. I mean, obviously, most of my opponents are getting money from people that they're going to ultimately be supervising cases related to. I mean, it's a very serious problem. You know, and I've talked to a friend of mine, Walt Schaub, who's who's the ethics head from the, you know, on the federal side, coming out of the both the Bush and Obama years, and, you know, about how you can deal with these problems. And I think the hard part about it is whenever we set a law in Illinois, politicians are always going to go, they just, in this state, they go to the bare minimum that the law requires. And we cannot, you know, have laws that are significant enough to deal with this because, as you point out, we have part-time legislators and they've got outside jobs. I mean, I think in an ideal world we would have full-time.
Yeah, but nobody wants a full-time politician.
Yeah, right. We don't want more of them doing that. I think what we really want to demand as voters, I think, is politicians that'll hold themselves to a higher standard and maybe, you know, have themselves be, you know, not only have more disclosure of where they're getting their money from and who they're meeting with, which I think often is more important than actually, or as important as where they're getting their money from. But I think recusing themselves out of more decisions than they are now. I mean, what we're seeing now is politicians getting money from the power company or getting money from a gas company and then making decisions based on that without ever disclosing that at the time that they're making that decision. And I think just the appearance that creates for our state is a problem.
So what ultimately separates you from the rest of the pack?
I'm the only person in the race who, literally, I've never ran for office and I haven't been appointed by ROM to anything. I'm not somebody who's really an insider or a politician in any way. I'm a person who is a former federal prosecutor who, like you pointed out, I would be on television or I'd be practicing law or whatever, and I'm coming at it from the outside. I'm somebody who's an able lawyer, you know, but I don't have any of the favors to trade or any of the, I'm not really beholden to anyone, and that really, in my view, that sets me apart from everyone else in the race. I'm running a campaign that is fueled by small money donations, thousands of people on the internet who are giving me $20 at a time, and I think that allows me to be somebody who represents the people and do what I believe is right, and even if you don't agree with everything I have to say, I'm an honest person and I'm not bought by anyone.
Renato Mariotti, to learn more about your campaign, where can people go?
They can go to my website, and I'm going to spell it because my name's a little tricky. RenatoMariotti.com. RenatoMariotti.com.
Renato Mariotti, Democratic candidate for Attorney General. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you very much. Real pleasure.